Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace. And today I'm going to show you how easy it is to add video. So you've probably seen this on the channel page. You've got the Admiral Nelson series. So now we're just going to go and add a new section in the edit function. So new blank section. And as you can see, there's a grid. So I'm just going to pull that grid up a little bit to minimize the gap in between. And then we're going to go and add a block, video block, go to edit, copy, paste in the link. So you go to add video, add from link, copy in the link, and it's the Battle of Jutland full documentary, the one that I released last week. Now, next thing is to scale it up. Now, obviously you can see there's the content box and that adapts to the grid and also to the size of the video thumbnail. Now, the title is near the top, so I'm just going to pull the video down a little bit and that will allow me to pull the title lock across. I want exactly the same format as the other titles, so I'm just going to copy and paste that over. I know it's a bit lazy, but it's easy. Change to the Battle of Jutland. One word on the second title doesn't look great, so let's make that just the one title. Scroll up a bit, drag the video up, and we're all ready to go. Video inserted into the page, save, exit. That easy. So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenefell. You can get a free trial, and once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show. Back in the late 19th century, public interest in the Royal Navy in Britain was a growing thing. Now, to be sure, there had been interest in Britain's main line of defence pretty much since the Royal Navy had come into existence, but in the 19th century, with greater public mobility thanks to the invention of the steam train and the establishment of the rail network, by the mid-1800s, the Royal Navy was something that was much more there for people in general, especially obviously those who headed down to the seaside for a coastal holiday, as opposed to something that was just, you know, an abstract that you might read about or hear about, well, unless you happen to live in Portsmouth or Chatham or something similar. This rather rapid capacity to move bulk goods around the country also meant that newspapers were far more widely available, engaging those who didn't regularly visit the seaside for pleasure or business. And of course, those newspapers could use the train to send their reporters out to gather all sorts of stories. Then there were a series of political reforms that widened the breadth of the population who could actually vote, which meant that more people felt that not only did they have an opinion on naval matters, but they'd also like to express it in some way that might actually affect how naval matters were conducted by the government. Another feature of this, for better or worse, was that between newspapers and various cheaply published books, often called penny dreadfuls, various waves of invasion hysteria would sweep across the UK every few years as some new technology, nation or navy rose to prominence, in the media at least, and was determined by somebody with at least vaguely passing rhetorical skills to pose an existential threat to the country. All of this meant that by the end of the 19th century, pretty much all levels of the wider population felt a lot more directly engaged with naval matters than they'd ever really done previously. But for those who were parts of the elements of society that had significant influence over things like potential naval matters, there was a bit of a problem. Many of their colleagues and friends with similar levels of influence proved to be rather easily swayed by either mass opinion or singularly ill-informed media pieces, and generally had very little that could tell them otherwise. Desiring to not only influence naval policy and doctrine in what they felt was, of course, the right direction, but also to provide a more solid backing to the positions they advocated rather than, well, I happened to read in the newspaper today, as well as, more generally, to assist in the field of naval academia, a group of historians, naval officers, academics, and not a few politicians decided to get together and found a society, as was the style of the time. In this case, Professor Sir John Knox Lawton and Admiral Sir Cyprian Bridge
would take the lead in amongst a few dozen like-minded individuals to found a new society. Admiral Bridge had a rather interesting pedigree. He'd been in the Navy since the middle of the century, and he was actually only one step removed from Nelson's time, having been nominated to a spot in the Navy by no less than Admiral Cochrane. Yes, the burn everything to the ground and salt the earth in the aftermath Admiral Cochrane, who was, of course, a contemporary of the Napoleonic Wars. Admiral Bridge had gone on to see action early on in his career in the Crimean War, as part of the Royal Navy's actions in the Arctic and the Pacific, before later seeing action in a couple of other colonial wars, and serving on almost every station that the Royal Navy possessed. Eventually, he would become a specialist on guns and armour, and by 1893, he was in command of the new battleship HMS Colossus over in the Pacific. In later years, he'd go on to command the Australian and China stations, although those two commands were, at this stage of proceedings, in his future. Now, students of naval history will scarcely need an introduction to Sir John Knox Lawton. But for those of you who might need such an introduction, he was born to a maritime family in 1830, joined the Royal Navy as a civilian instructor in 1853, and despite this technical civilian status, went on to see action in the Crimean War and in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, since it turns out that if you're on a ship that's under fire, especially in the middle of the Victorian period, pretty much everybody on board gets involved in shooting back. He would remain at sea for over a decade until finally coming ashore to teach at the Royal Navy College in Portsmouth in 1866, which is where he remained until it moved to Greenwich in 1873, whereupon he relocated to follow it. During the 1870s, he advocated for historians to follow the then new approach of not just reporting events in history, i.e. what happened, but actually also analysing those events. That might seem like almost something you wouldn't have to say at all these days, but back in the 1870s, this was a radical new approach to history. In 1885, he finished his naval career and then moved on to teach history more generally at King's College in London, which is, perhaps confusingly, actually a university. These days, one of the most prestigious seats in the naval history profession as a whole remains the Lawton Professor position of naval history at King's College. Among those who read Lawton's works with interest when it came to forming their own theses and opinion on naval matters were such figures as Julian Corbett and one US naval officer, Alfred Thayer Mahan. But going back to 1893 and the newly formed society, Lawton and Bridge decided this should be named the Navy Records Society, or NRS. And this name and its goals were chosen for good reason, although there was a little bit of discussion about the name. It could have gone either way at first. Lawton, in particular, had already persuaded the Royal Navy to allow him access to its archives, then held at what was called the Public Records Office, but he'd also managed to persuade the Royal Navy to allow at least some limited access to its archives for civilians. But the key word there was limited, both in terms of what you were actually allowed to access, and of course, being the late 19th century, there was also something of a limit on just how many civilians actually had the time and the spare cash to find their way to the Royal Navy's archives at all, if they didn't happen to live nearby in the first place. And so access to what we would today refer to primarily as primary sources remained limited. Enter the Navy Records Society. Their purpose was to publish original, often rare, historical naval documents in the form of papers, or most of the time in the case of bound volume books, especially when compiling numerous related documents into one place. Now this, of course, would allow the interested reader not only to save time and effort of potentially having to locate and then carefully handle dozens of original documents all in one place, but it also meant that you could have access to these documents in the comfort of your own home whenever you wanted to. And thus, if you wanted to publish one of the newfangled analytical histories, or if you just wanted to stake or refute a position on the latest invasion scare and how it could be handled, And perhaps in that case you wanted to back up your claims by referencing, well, the last time the Royal Navy had needed to fight a mass invasion fleet up the Channel, obviously the Spanish Armada back in the 16th century, well, now you could do so with considerably more accuracy, as the first two volumes published by the Navy Record Society were the collected state papers and correspondence that related to the Armada campaign. With the added bonus of not only was it all in one place, but it was in a neatly printed, legible font, as opposed to wild and occasionally illegible 16th century handwriting. The Navy Record Society, of course, had come into existence at a time of particular naval interest. After some decades building a slow but steady stream of ships that mostly either embodied some specific new idea or technology, or had been built as a rather specific counter to some foreign ship, the Royal Navy was in the middle of a major growth phase. Even as the Ironclad was giving way to the pre-dreadnought, large classes of standardised designs were beginning to take shape on the slipways of the United Kingdom, and, of course, in response, pretty much all the other shipyards across Europe. And the issue of this new naval arms race was enough to even bring down governments, who were forced into naval spending even if they didn't necessarily want to be. As such, many enthusiastic members of the new society actually had day jobs as politicians, or were in politically related roles, but obviously if you were a member of the Navy Record Society, they were generally of the faction that advocated for the Navy. It was, of course, an interesting era for an organisation that's still going these days. At that point, HMS Warrior was still listed as an active warship, not a museum or even an oil jetty. Oil itself wasn't considered a fuel for ships at this point and wouldn't be for at least a decade or two. HMS Victory was still riding quite happily at anchor in Portsmouth Harbour. The aircraft and the steam turbine were still just thoughts in the minds of their eventual inventors. And so the Navy Record Society got underway with its goals clearly established in its first constitution. The first goal would be the editing and publication of manuscripts illustrating the history, organisation or social life of the Navy. The second was the reprinting of rare or generally inaccessible works of naval interest. And third would be the publication of translations of similar manuscripts or works that could be found in foreign languages. But in those days, being a member of the Navy Record Society didn't just mean sitting back in your townhouse, paying your one guinea a year and waiting for the next edition. The membership was quite active. Over the first decade or two of its existence, various members of the society ceased paying their dues courtesy of Boer War bullets in South Africa, early submarine dives that had gone awry, and various other late British imperial shenanigans. But the society would continue to gain in members and strength, even if World War I caused a brief pause in publication and a somewhat understandable drop in the number of active members. Time moved on, though, and by the 1960s, the papers of some of the officers who'd actually been active founding members were now themselves considered historical enough to merit publication in their own right. And so things have gone on. Nowadays, the Navy Record Society is, I'm happy to say, still going strong, and the most recent volumes published have covered a wide range of topics, from the third volume of Admiral Milne's papers, which cover the Royal Navy's interest in and observations of the American Civil War, to the late 1940s planning for the post-World War II Royal Navy, and most recently, the letters and papers of Samuel Bentham, who was the Inspector General of Naval Works at the height of the Napoleonic Wars and oversaw the introduction of quite a few technological innovations to the Royal Dockyards. In the time from 1893 to 2025, when this video is being published, the Navy Record Society has published documents going all the way back to the 1200s, the Angevin and Plantagenet navies, and followed that all the way through the subsequent 800 years or so of naval history. Now, although, of course, primarily publishing on British naval matters, there have been a number of volumes on foreign navies and general maritime law, and since 2012, there's also been a section of smaller articles published in an online magazine. A team of complete heroes also have managed to put together scanned PDF copies of practically every single book and article ever published by the NRS all the way back to 1893, and so there's actually no such thing as an out-of-print edition. So why am I telling you about all of this, and how do you get access to this wealth of material? Well, partially I'm telling you about this because, well, it's really interesting and useful, at least to me. And also, partially, the rather wonderful Dr. Sam Willis, author and historian, brought me aboard to the NRS in part to help promote it to a newer generation. So if you sometimes wonder where I keep coming up with all these little bits of information in terms of first-person correspondence from the people who were there and experiencing various things, well, sometimes that is my own archival research. Sometimes people supply me with their ancestors' diaries, particularly for World War I and World War II. But quite often it's also because I happen to have access to the Navy Record Society's library of, as mentioned, digital publications, because I'm a member. Now, if you'd like to be able to support the work the Navy Record Society does, as well as, you know, incidentally accessing over 130 years of compiled naval history, you can do so by becoming a member via their website, as you see on screen. Your year-long membership fee will allow you access to the entire digital volume collection and give you the option to receive any physical editions that are published while you happen to be a member. And if you're in the UK, there are also various events and trips that will get organised throughout the year. And so while this is a relatively brief video today, I hope it's one that you find very useful, and I hope that in the next board meeting of the Navy Record Society, we'll be able to report a rather nice uptick in new memberships. But that's all for today. Thanks very much for listening, and see you again in another video soon.